Live from Burbank, California, where you can always find a dead whale in the river. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, scientists are puzzled. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Of course, you lurking conservatives. And as always, need machines, pain sponges. We're here to feed you in a funny way if we can. Hope you're having a good day. It is Friday. We're going to have some fun today. Not like we don't have fun every day a little bit, even though things are really bad and awful and it's over. But no, we have a good show today. We're going to do a little music, if that's okay. We're going to talk to Vic Gabberini. He's going to give us the Vic's Picks. We're trying to label that segment, even though we've only talked to him once. He's a friend of Bill Kolar's, Sweepy Bill Kolar, the producer here. Trippy Bill Kolar. He goes by a couple different nicknames. Here's another one. Dude. He's a friend of Bill's. So he's I'm not going to say an older guy, but, you know, apparently the albums we're going to go over today are a David Gilmour album, because I'm sure the kids are chomping at the bits for information on the wrenching noodling from one of the great psychedelic bands of the century, Pink Floyd. There's going to be a review of that. We're going to talk about that, and I had to listen to it. And, mind you, I am a Pink Floyd person. I've spent many an evening high on the reefer playing air guitar to Animals, my friends. And Animals, that's not everybody's cup of tea as a Pink Floyd album. But let me tell you, when that guitar kicks in on Pigs in the Wing, hey, you know, that's it. It's over, nurse. Is that what the saying is? I'm bad with those things. And he's going to review Paul Simon's new album. Paul Simon has teamed up with Brian Eno. The album, I believe, hold on. I believe the album is called Surprise. And you know what the surprise is? It sucks. It's horrendous. And I am a fan of Brian Eno and Paul Simon. But Surprise, whoo, boy, the old Jews got to put the guitar away. You know, there's some old Jews that can still wrench out a few good noodles, but this one's done. Stick a fork in him. It's over for Paul Simon. And again, big Paul Simon fan. Liked a lot of his solo work. Love Simon and Garfunkel. I am a supporter of Paul Simon. But sometimes you just got to sit down and look at your fat and go, maybe it's time to sit down and look at my fat. You know, people like Bob Dylan. He's one of the great old Jews that still maintains the ability to stay interesting, I think. Anyways, it's not a religious thing. The third album he's going to do, I believe we're going to talk about the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Again, not a new band, but a staple. Certainly not an old band in the same way that Pink Floyd or Paul Simon might be. But, man, good. It's a great album, and it's two of them. And that's rare that two CDs actually maintain goodness all the way through. No sign of the hummingbird for those of you who are like, "What? When's Maron going to talk about the hummingbird that he pulled off it broke its wing and he put in a napkin bed in a bowl in his garage and disappeared, the mythic hummingbird that Jim has named Hummer, cleverly named Hummer, the mythic hummingbird."
Mm-hmm.
Still no sign of him. And I had a cat in the garage today, and he didn't find him either. So
he got away.
Perhaps he did. Perhaps there may not be any ending to this. Let's talk a little bit about what happened in the House today, as best as I can see it. The House, the GOP-led House, voted 256 to 153 to approve a non-binding resolution that says an arbitrary date of the withdrawal or redeployment of American forces in Iraq is not in the national interest. Now, I think the encouraging thing to see here is you got 153 who voted against the approval, many of them Democrats who stood up. It's taken this long, but they are standing up. There is enough momentum, I guess, but nationally against this war for them to take a stand. And this whole thing was a charade, as we know and we've talked about yesterday. This entire resolution was a charade. The attempt was, look, the marriage amendment thing didn't get George Bush a bump in the polls. The immigration thing is confusing to people. Well, here you got Zarqawi dead. And he said, this is our opportunity. This is our window. I'm going to fly there. I'm going to sit next to the new Iraqi prime minister. We're going to say, things are looking up. Everything's going great. Here we go. You guys are almost on your own. But we're never leaving. So what this guy Boehner does, Majority House Leader John Boehner, puts together this ridiculous resolution as a theatrical stunt to put Democrats, you know, on the to put them in the corner, to try to corner them on this idea that Democrats are soft on terror or soft on war, or bad at national security. This is a completely Rovian manipulation of the Congress in order to make points with what is left of Bush's base and as they depart. There's no way anyone can deny the fact that this war is failing. And the other thing that Boehner tried to do with this resolution, as I talked about yesterday, was intrinsically is interconnect the war in Iraq with the war on terror. And these are two definitely different things. And the bottom line is both of them are being lost. And this is I was proud of some Democrats. I can't list them all by name, but I was proud that at least there was some momentum there. Certainly John Murtha made some momentum. And I also was kind of impressed. A Republican actually said something that I think it resonates, because there is a break in their ranks as well around this stuff. This war. A guy named Wayne T. Gilchrist of Maryland, he's a congressman, he said, quote, "I can't help but feel through the eyes of a combat-wounded Marine in Vietnam. If someone was shot, you tried to save his life while you were in combat. You had a sense of urgency to end the slaughter. And around here, we don't have that sense of urgency. To me, the administration does not act like there's a war going on. The Congress certainly doesn't act like there's a war going on. If you're raising money to keep the majority, if you're thinking about gay marriage, if you're doing all this other peripheral stuff, what does that say to the guy who's about ready to drive over a landmine?" End quote. This is a Republican. So this is on both sides. A certain amount of disillusionment, a certain amount of anger, a certain amount of I'm tired of this crap. And a certain demand, I would hope. The one thing that we could hope is for Congress to honor the demand for them to do their job on oversight of this administration's engagement with this thing. I don't know how it's going to play out, but that's where that stands as of now, as of when we're reporting this. There's a choice on behalf of the Democrats chose to vote Congressman Jefferson. Why did I just space his name? Congressman Jefferson.
Yes.
To go ahead and vote him off his committee because he had money in his refrigerator. See, I think that they should have left him on. I think that, you know, given the way the stock market is going, the way things are up and down, I think this guy might be onto something. I think that, you know, there's only a few places you can hide, you know, packages of money. And I think that perhaps saving it in the refrigerator, despite where he got it, and it's not clear that it was a bribe. It's not clear. But they chose to go ahead and do this when everything else is going on, when we need to stand together. You know, the Democrats voted to push this guy out. I've got some money in my refrigerator.
Yeah, I've been accumulating gold in my freezer.
You're accumulating gold? Do you have any gold?
Oh, I've been accumulating a lot of gold.
That's tremendous.
Yeah.
Because I hear gold's the thing to do.
I go to the Knott's Berry Farm, you know, they have this little, panning exhibit there, and I just get like an ounce or two every few weeks.
And how do you like that? It's real gold, huh?
It is.
Imagine that.
Over 40 years now.
Hey, let me ask you a question.
It's collected into a lot.
That's great. I'm glad you got something to bank your future on. You know, that you have some security there in the fridge and the gold.
Everybody needs a little security, Mark.
You're telling me, mister. Hey, let me ask you a question. Whole Foods out of Austin, Texas, a place where I am not going to shop anymore. All right, it has nothing to do with this. I just find it's inconsistent and overpriced, and I question the integrity of the salad bar in terms of are those vegetables about to be thrown away? That's my only question with Whole Foods. Okay, they are not necessarily a politically correct market in all senses of the word progressive, because they have meat. Right? They have meat, Jim.
Well,
lots of it.
I understand that part, yeah.
Okay, they got lots of meat.
Maybe free-range meat, huh?
Some of that.
Yeah.
You know, free-range meat, clean pigs.
If people are going to eat meat, it should be clean and free-range.
Free-range and the pigs should be clean.
You know.
As clean as those pigs can be. Now, here's the question. Thursday, that's yesterday, they decided to stop selling live lobsters and crabs on the grounds that it's inhumane.
They feel pain.
Fine.
They feel pain. It's horrible. Have you ever seen those poor things being caught in the Alaskan, in the Bering Sea?
I've heard them when I put them into a steamer, my friend. They scream. You ever heard a lobster scream when you throw them in the boiling water? This is my question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't look at me like I'm an ass. I mean, I don't eat that many. How many lobsters do I really eat? One. I've eaten lobster at home maybe once or twice in my life.
okay? And it felt bad, okay? And I'm not steaming hummingbirds, all right? I make a napkin bed for hummingbirds. Okay. Now, Bill, you're coming into my studio. It's got to be important. Right, right. There are other guests on the show.
Bill lost his stash.
He did?
Yeah. Trying to find out if he left it in the studio. Because he's a hippie.
He just came in and gave me a note that said, remember, we're on the radio. Look, I am kidding. So what do you think of that? It seems to me that if you got a little tank with some crabs and some lobsters in it that you buy and it's your choice to go home, who knows? Maybe people are buying them to throw them back into the water and free them. I mean, doesn't it seem sort of hypocritical for Whole Foods to say, hey, we're not going to do this anymore because we're good guys, yet there's an entire counter full of dead animals that they buy into that are already dead? They are, and this is a question for you because I think it's ridiculous. Just sell the damn lobsters and crabs. It's not even on them. To what happens to those babies when they leave.
Well, I guess it's splitting hairs. I guess it depends on how those other animals are treated before they're slaughtered and killed. You know, the lobsters all go through this lingering period of pain. You know when they're thrown onto those fishing boats in the Bering Sea, sometimes it's so cold that their legs pop off.
Wow.
You know, and there's nothing left but the little round body of the lobster there.
The good part, the tasty part?
No. Nothing's tasty about it. You know why? Because it's an animal, a fellow animal in extreme pain. How would you like it if the roles were reversed? And human beings lived in the ocean? Human beings were being...
Farmed by lobsters?
Brought up in these pots and thrown down onto the deck of this freezing fishing boat by a bunch of... vulgarity spewing fishermen and yo ho, and then one of them takes a bite out of it, like it's for the camera, you know.
Now, wait, are these lobster people doing this?
Yeah, lobster people.
So you're saying that how would I feel if lobster people caught me in a net and went yo-ho, and then took a bite of me for a photograph taken by one of their lobster friend?
Mishna was in the other net. It's not a net, really, but it's a pot. It's a metal pot that they bring up. But Mishna's in the other one. And
screaming.
She's screaming. She's so cold.
And she goes, look, my arm fell off.
Yeah, and she falls down on the deck, and her arms all pop off.
Wow, this is so trippy, man.
Yeah, and you have some,
smart comment.
Yeah.
Hey, sorry, baby. I guess we won't be doing that anymore. Yeah. Something like that.
Looks like we lost $20.
Oh, ho!
See?
Yeah.
We're only like an inch away in the human evolution from that happening.
See, I knew this would be good stuff for you. But I guess the real question is, would I be comfortable in a tank at Whole Foods?
I don't know. It depends. Do they know how to actually keep a lobster free from pain in a tank? I mean, shouldn't it have salt water? What's the temperature? All this stuff. What do you feed it? People don't care. They don't care.
They don't. But I do care about my hummingbird, and I don't eat that much lobster. But I understand your point, kind of. But you know what the weird thing is that we're kind of smarter than lobsters. Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen, what you're talking about.
So you're saying we should be eating and roasting retarded children?
No.
Because we're smarter than them.
I'd go for that. I personally wouldn't prefer it, but I think there's an argument to be made. We'll be back in a second.
And now the House rejected his timetable for pullout. Mark Maron.
Hey, Jim, I'm sorry you're ill, man, and I feel bad about the lobsters, and I don't want to eat retarded kids. Where do you stand on bugs? You cool with the bugs?
Yeah, I guess so.
What, because bugs don't feel pain? Do you know quantitatively that bugs don't feel pain?
No, I don't. You caught me on that.
No, but I mean, I just think it's weird the way you pick and choose sometimes.
Well, you know, I don't think bugs aren't extinct. You know, they aren't going extinct. A lot of them aren't, I guess.
But who knows? I think...
lobsters
I'm
are.
Not going to... Lobsters are extinct?
They're in danger. That's why we have strict seasons for them.
I got an email that made me feel good, kind of. Mark Maron, loved the show is the subject line. I totally wrote you off on the morning show because whenever I listened to that show, it sounded like I had no chemistry, though I like Sue Ellicott on NPR. So there's a strike against this person right off the bat. When the documentary came out, I was all excited because I was really enjoying Al Franken and Gene Garofalo. But in that documentary, I thought you came off like a total a-hole. So, like, and I'm still reading, right? Yeah. And when you were a guest on Majority Report a long time ago, you weren't so bad. So one day when I was really bored, I downloaded a podcast, and now I'm totally hooked. You have a great show with a great mix of comedy and issues and seemingly honest personality. What is this? All right. You won me over from indifference to mild dislike to a hardcore fan. You're straight up the best thing on Air America and way up there among my favorite radio shows altogether. Way to go, man. Take a victory lap. Hold on. Let me get on it. Here I go. No, thank you for the email. It's very nice. Let's take this one. Here we go. Hi, Mark. Ann Coulter's just speaking the truth, and the left can't handle it. Oh, no. It's happening.
And now, from Radio Halliburton, it's America's favorite late-night far-right radio show, Shark and Awe, with Mark the Shark Maron.
Good evening, neocons! Radio Halliburton, where the truth hurts. Hey, everybody. Everything's looking good in Iraq. USA, USA, USA. Mark the Shark's even got an interview with Al Zarqawi. Whoa, is he dead? Yep, that's too bad. And there was so much I wanted to ask him, like, how does this feel? Good luck in heaven with those virgins with your wiener blown off, loser. Hey, let's read an email. Dear Mark the Shark, what do you think of Karl Rove getting off? What do I think?
Can't touch this.
Get it? You can't touch him. Get it? Karl Rove, he's untouchable. Get it? Hey, liberals, next time try to bring down something your own size, like a fetus. Speaking of babes, how about that Ann Coulter, huh? 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 I can feel my dorsal fin surfacing, people, if you know what I mean. I have an erection. I still have an erection. Ann's got a new book called Godless, The Church of Liberalism, and let me tell you, I'm down on my knees. You know what really got me going? Down, little mud shark. I loved it when Ann called out those skanky 9/11 widows.
Oh, my husband got killed at the World Trade Center. Now that I scammed millions of dollars from the government, I can have sex with lots of smelly hippies just like I always dreamed of. I can trash President Bush all the time and get as many late-term abortions as I want to. Maybe I'll marry a woman now and make a fortune when she dies.
Stick around, neocons. We'll be back with Toby Keith.
Oh, man. Hey, why is my nose bleeding? What the hell just happened, man?
I'm sorry, Mark. I left the studio. I was smoking some hash with
the lobster people?
Yeah, Bill. I was,
with the lobster
Bill
people.
Found us. The lobster people. Yeah, I was smoking hash out of a lobster leg.
Vic Garbarini's going to be here to talk about some old farts. All right? That's good, though, man. What am I? I'm 42. Be back in a second.
How can you live in the Northeast? How can you live in the South? How can you build on the banks of a river when the floodwater pours from the mouth?
His feet are duck-like fossils. Mark Maron.
Oh, thank you, Jim. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I didn't mean to interrupt you saying my name. Look, I forgot to set up the show because apparently I'm just an unprofessional radio personality. But look, later in the show, we got Steve Hill, the author of 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, an owner's manual for concerned citizens. That should make you happy. I was at the Sam Cedar event last night where I played a part in one of his sketches.
I heard you were very bubbly.
That was on his show. We had a great time on the Majority Report. I like Sam. It was nice. He did his event with Steve and Cheryl, and there's a nice little crowd. It literally became a town meeting afterwards where people wanted answers, wanted change. That's a very interesting thing.
Answers?
Yeah.
You gave them answers?
I don't do it as much. Sam provided some insights, but it's just very interesting that there's very passionate, very angry, frustrated, but engaged, base to Air America and to his show and to what we're trying to do here. And I think Steve Hill is going to give us a lot of answers. Some of the answers to the questions that we had last night, a lot of people concerned about voting machines and about, you know, how do we manifest a grassroots a momentum. So that'll be good. I also wanted to quickly read this email that related to something that Vic Garbarini, our next guest, and Andy Ostroy will be here from ostroyreport.blogspot.com. My buddy's a blogger. But here's an email in relation to the Ethan Smith interview we did, the Wall Street Journal music industry analyst. Someone said, listen, Mark, you really pissed me off yesterday. What is your problem with the Dixie Chicks? Because you obviously have a big one. Of all the cool guests you have had on, why did you stoop to having that jerk, nerd, no personality writer from the Wall Street Journal on who doesn't even have the nads to admit whether he likes their album? Wouldn't it have been more appropriate to have someone from the Rolling Stone or Cream? I can't help but feel from your comments yesterday and prior comments that you really don't like the Dixie Chicks. As a longtime rock and roll fan who absolutely detests traditional country music and their redneck fans, yes, I said redneck, I've always loved the Dixie Chicks, even before they said their infamous Bush remark. All that did was make me like them even more. Anyway, stop bagging on them because you're making me mad, Caps. And you don't like me when I'm angry. P.S. Jim, will you smack Mark upside the head for me? Thanks. That's Cindy in San Diego. I like the Dixie Chicks. And I the reason we had him on was to just sort of assess the situation with their tour and how that unfolded. Granted, Ethan was a little prickly. But I have nothing against the Dixie Chicks. I've been listening to the hell out of the album in my car. Well, I've listened to it twice. But here we go. Our next and it's not. It's good. It's well-produced.
You like it?
It's
really?
Catchy. Yeah, I mean, it is what it is, you know, and I'm proud of them. And I've said that before. I just, Cindy's a little, she's gone overboard. Our next guest has been writing about music for years. He was the creator and editor of the Old Musician magazine. He was nominated for a Grammy for his interview with Paul McCartney. He's written for Rolling Stone, GQ, Spin, Mojo. He was a music columnist at Playboy for 17 years, and he is currently working on two book projects and the American editor for Classic Rock magazine in the UK. The reason he's on our show is to talk about today. Here's what we're talking about today. These are Vic's picks today. The Red Hot Chili Peppers, Stadium Arcadium, new Chili Peppers, a few weeks old, two CDs worth of them. Paul Simon, surprise. Surprise, it sucks, Paul Simon. David Gilmour, On an Island, and he should be with this record, I think. How are you, Vic?
I am fine. I am doing well down here in the South where we do understand the problem with the Dixie Chicks.
Hey, let me ask you a question about that. My inkling is that maybe they overreached given the state of their cultural appeal to their old base, but perhaps they should have planned some smaller venues and it wouldn't have been any problem at all.
No, the key to it really is, at least around this town, is that, you know, their concert after they made that initial remark, their concerts were very well attended. I think it's had a chance, you know, a lot of the right-wing talk jocks have had a chance to set in on this and basically do, you know, what the Republicans do, which is, you know, make an emotional kind of, you know, image of these people that, you know, that is, you know, that touches all those fear and greed.
Right, right.
And
so you're saying
buttons.
He kind of ruined it. They threw the mojo on him.
Right. And the thing is, what they're keying it to now, and you could say this is a cause or excuse, is when they've done interviews recently, I think this was one of the sisters, too. This was not Natalie.
Yeah.
All of them are like this. They said, hey, we don't even want the kind of people that would just put us on a CD changer with Reba McEntire and Toby Keith. Now, if you're not from the South and you don't know country music, you don't know what that code is.
That's basically saying the Virgin Mary and Jesus are not our friends.
No, the thing is, Reba McEntire is almost like the biggest Republican in town. There was a piece in something like Entertainment Weekly the other day where talked about her, you know, she's got Bush Sr.'s cell phone, so she saw him at a ball game and called him up. And she also made a comment about the Dixie Chicks at a recent awards thing.
Yeah, right, that's right.
And the other thing very quickly about Toby Keith is I've met Toby Keith, and he is a sentient being, but, you know, Toby Keith is, again, took up the right-wing thing as soon as Bush came in, waving the flag. He's the one who had the fake picture of Saddam Hussein and Natalie the Dixie Chicks sort of as if they were shaking hands and so on.
He's an ass.
So these girls have had death threats, and their attitude is, and Southern women are not supposed to be allowed to do this. This is so important.
Yeah.
And that's why the passion comes from in that album.
Okay.
It's not about anger. It's about we're finally free,
yeah.
And screw you if you don't like it.
Exactly. We talked about that last time, and I think that's beautiful. Now let's get into this. Red Hot Chili Peppers, Stadium Arcadium. Gave it one listen today. Got to be honest with you. About 15 songs in to a 28-song collection, I found that the album not only picked up, but I found myself listening to cuts that are like 14 or 15 songs into this thing two or three times, one right after the other. That's a sign of a good record.
Well, this is where it's all come together for them. They are now being billed as the biggest band in America, and they probably are. And it's got something to do with, I think, also rock and roll as an instrument for consciousness and spirituality and politics and everything else. You know, on the basic level, as I once said to Joe Strummer of The Clash, how can you expect to tell your society or the world what to do and have them believe you if you can't, you know, get the four members of your band together on a one point and agree? I mean, you know, it begins at home. It begins with yourself. And the thing is, these guys have been through drugs. They've been through deaths. Their guitar player, John Frusciante, left the band 6 years on heroin.
Let's talk.
Comes back, and it's really Frusciante's album.
Let's talk about that a minute. Is there anybody on the planet at this point in time that has as much respect for the sound of a Stratocaster than that guy?
No, and the thing is, he was always known in the past for being a Hendrix fan, and there's two sides of the Hendrix. There's the kind of little wing thing where you're doing those, you know, kind of low-key, lovely little figures and so on, like you put in Under the Bridge.
Flourishes.
And then there's the roaring Hendrix side. This album, he's really let loose with his inner Hendrix, which comes from his friendship with Omar Rodriguez of Mars Volta, who he's been hanging with and who just said, look, on a song like this, crank it up. And the whole band is integrated personally and musically in a way where, you know, on the old album, you know, Give It Away was a great funk tune, and Under the Bridge was a great ballad.
Right.
And it's like those two aspects of themselves, the funk, the rock, the insight, you know, the songs about life, really, rather than wearing a sock on you or whatever, have really come together, and
it's all very
double album since the White Album.
It's all very lyrical, it's all very tasteful, and it's very honest. It's the one great thing about the Peppers, and you know, I'm a fan. I'm not a huge fan. I have been a huge fan for certain records, but the great thing that really carries these guys outside of the amazing instrumentation and the tightness of the band is that Anthony always sounds like he's like, look, I am gonna sing the best I can. You know, I may not sing as good as some people, but man, I'm going to do it the best I can on this song.
Right, and actually it's a very good point, Mark, because most of the harmonies you're hearing in the background, which are almost Beatlesque or Beach Boys or whatever,
a bunch of them.
That's all Anthony. That's a lot of that is Anthony and John Frusciante again, working together.
Nice.
So, they're clicking on all levels now, and they've reached, I hate to use a word like maturity, because that was always a forbidden word in rock and roll, but that's what it is.
That's good. All right, let's move on. Let's go from maturity to senility. Paul Simon. Paul Simon.
David Gilmour?
We'll go both. Look, I love Paul Simon. I've liked a lot of his records. I think he's brilliant, but I think that this album sucks, and I love Brian Eno. I just think, let me give you my opinion first. I think that the amazing thing about Paul Simon has always been a sense of vocal restraint, a sense of muted production in terms of how he uses different textures and music, and it just seems that these two guys are at odds with each other. The songwriting quality is not that good, and his voice does not hold up in an Eno mix. What do you think?
I was inclined to agree, but I have to respectfully disagree, my lord, on this one. Listening to it more, the thing about Simon is, it's like there are two schools. There's a Dylan school, which is, you know, he let it all pour through when he was younger, and all these cerebral images. But Simon has sometimes been sort of you know, castigated as a bit of a middle brow. But what he's really doing is he speaks in emotional images. And when a Simon thing works, you get these kind of pieces almost of vivid narrative.
Yeah, poetic.
Chunks of poetry that kind of don't make sense, but they do.
Right.
Like one of his best phrases on this album, which you may have heard before, is nothing is different, but everything has changed. And that's what I get on this. And what bled through on the album, I didn't like the kind of sharp, you know, kind of Chad Blake drumming, but Bill Frisell is the most underrated musician in the country. He's a guitar player who can play
sort
of brittle, crystalline music and make it sound fluid like liquid. And that worked with Simon's voice. And the thing about Simon is he's always been an experimenter. And you're right. You know, he was doing reggae before anybody else. He was doing, obviously, African music, then Brazilian music. And I would always listen to it and go, you know, I really like this. Or at first I would think it doesn't work. And then after a while it would sort of blend together for me. And I'm finding on this album that I'm literally, parts of my heart and my brain are getting tickled by what he's saying, because also there is a line to what he's saying similar to Chili Peppers that's talking about reaching a certain age.
Yeah, there definitely is.
Coming to certain conclusions. All on Paul.
He's an old guy, and it's sad because he doesn't know if Edie's going to like him anymore. Now, look.
He's dour, is what he actually is.
All right, we'll be back. We'll talk about David Gilmour, a little bit about Paul McCartney. So stay with us. On the phone is Vic Garbarini.
Just lost his appeal in Vietnam. Mark Maron.
Thank you. You know that guitar sound. You know it. You love it. It's the monster sustain noodler, David Gilmour, with the big sound. But you know what? I got to be honest, Vic Garbarini, our music critic. This is the Vic's Pick segment. I got to be honest with you, man. I only listened to it once. I couldn't even get through it. Thank God there's only 10 songs on it. I do respect them for making a reasonable-sized record. But, man, did I get snoozy.
Okay, in this case, I'd have to go back to what you said about Paul Simon, and if I can borrow a phrase, this record really sucks, Mark. And the thing about it is he's giving you signals all along.
That it sucks?
Yeah, that it sucks. First of all, it's called On an Island.
Yeah. Help! You know, and he's screaming, it's a cry for help.
And I think it's about his state of mind. Pink Floyd, of course, if you grew up in the 70s, is this mythical band. They get together again at Live 8. You've got two completely different personalities. Gilmour, very introverted, very lyrical, speaks through his guitar. And you've got
Roger Waters,
who is just basically a control freak and a megalomaniac and has to get his whole story of his miserable childhood across.
And always the ghost of Sid Barrett hanging over them.
Right, and acted very sort of beastly about it. And basically, suddenly Roger Waters, after 20 years, after Live 8, goes, let's get Pink Floyd together again. We'll get into the garage and go out on a tour. And it's Gilmour who's putting his foot down and saying, as the Beatles would, not a second time. I don't want to do that. And that's all through this album.
Yeah.
The song Heaven is the only decent thing, the one you were playing there, because that's an affirmation about why what he does care about, his family, his friends, those elements of his life. Everything else sounds like all those, middle parts of Dark Side of the Moon with
the sax
and the synthesizers, where you were kind of stoned, you couldn't remember how long it goes on.
Yeah.
That's what it is. There's no center to the song.
Okay, so in other words, for hardcore Pink Floyd fans, this might be just your record you've been waiting for. Now,
only if you're extremely
high
in an altered state of consciousness.
All right. Paul McCartney, who you did one of the seminal interviews with, is going to be 64 on Sunday. He's been through some rough times. Let me tell you, this gal he was with. I still think he did all right for himself. But so what are your thoughts? What are your reflections on Paul McCartney turning 64?
Well, my first thought is how relieved Pete Townsend must feel after that, hope I die before I get old thing that people have been bugging him about since he turned 30.
Yeah.
At least now the attention's on McCartney. And I don't know, did McCartney think he'd be worth $1.5 billion and in the middle of a divorce from an activist where he doesn't have a prenup at 64? Still, that would leave him with only about $1.5 billion.
What's a guy going to do with that?
Yeah. The thing about it is he, to his credit, in the past 10 years, most of the albums he's done, he's really been taking himself to task, because it's very easy for him to just do the lazy thing, and he's admitted it, and he's challenged himself more and more on these albums, which doesn't mean they're great, but you could put together one pretty decent greatest hits from stuff he's done over the past 10 years. However, for Beatles fans or for anybody that's interested in the Beatles, I've read, every book that's ever been put out on the Beatles. I was lucky enough to interview all of them at one time or another, although I'm not that old.
Yeah.
But there's a book that's just come out called Here, There, and Everywhere, My Life Recording the Beatles by Jeff Emmerich, and Jeff is with a G. This is the engineer who at the age of 20, his first day on the job was the first day of recording Revolver.
Oh.
And John Lennon just stood up there and said, "We want everything to sound different. I've got a song, it's only got one chord in it, and I want my voice to sound like the Dalai Lama on a mountain." And
Emmerich did it, huh?
And he pulled it off by basically with strings and wires. In those days of four-track and EMI really was a terrible studio, this guy invented most of the things that the Beatles were calling for on all of those albums.
Yeah, all right. Well, listen, Vic, I think that was the album also that has become the seminal record to all the hipsters and the pop heads. And I appreciate your time, buddy.
Always something or other.
That was very touching. I appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon, Vic.
Take care.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
In a few minutes, we're going to get Andy Ostroy out here. We'll get back to politics and the state of the world. Andy Ostroy is one of the great, he is a promoter, a great promoter of the Al Gore presidential run. I actually think that he probably secretly stalks Al Gore, pestering him to run for president. So we're going to probably talk a little bit about that and other stuff in a second. How's that? Is that okay? All right, Jim?
Did you hear
that? Beatles. What's in the Beatles, Jim?
Oh, that's Paul McCartney. Yeah, but it's Beatles.
Oh, we're going to be back in a second. Still feed me when I'm 64. Every summer we can rent a cottage in the Isle of Wight.
He's not afraid to debate gay clergy, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Man, we are just a couple of snot bags, aren't we? Hopefully by Monday, we'll be all cleared up.
I'd prefer a different term, but sure, yeah.
How about, I don't know.
Congested? Infected?
What? You're very touchy when you're
virus.
I come up with a nice, kind of poetic, punchy, like, snot bag.
Snot bag. What is
and
this?
And you're like,
is this high school or something?
Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is high school.
That may appeal to your audience.
Oh, you're making the guests uncomfortable. You have a higher what?
Higher clientele.
You
I'm
do?
Trying to say.
Really?
Sure.
Okay. You want me to maybe do some highlights of some of your books or your bits?
Sure, why not?
All right, look. Folks, I've been reading the Ostroy Report for over a year now. Andy Ostroy is an astute political observer, but more than that, he's just a guy that wanted to make a difference. And started doing his blog, a little public TV show back there in New York, the Ostroy Delay Report, where Democrats play rough. He's actually out here in L.A., and he's actually in our studio. You can go to ostroyreport.blogspot.com as we're speaking right now. How are you, Andy Ostroy?
Oh, doing well, Mark. Glad to be here.
You got a paper in front of you? So let's start with, maybe you got some thoughts on this. Explain to me, it's a good thing that this horrendous bit of political theater that John Boehner manufactured for the House there actually brought some nads out of the Democrats, it looks like, didn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, the Democrats are trying to find their way on Iraq.
Uh-huh.
And what we're seeing from the Republicans right now is, you know, you talk about theater, they're going back to 2004. Right mm-hmm. now, it's all about Iraq, and it's Iraq being morphed into terrorism being morphed into, you know, fight them over there before we have to fight them over here. And, you know, the struggle that you're seeing within the Democratic Party is, and this was evidenced by, you know, the differences between how Hillary Clinton and John Kerry were received yesterday in this Take Back America event. You know, you have some people in the Democratic Party who are saying, let's cut and run, according to the Republicans. But the reality is, let's just find an exit strategy and pull the troops out because we're not really going anywhere.
Well, what I've been saying, and it seems to me what they're trying to do, is this whole thing was set up to put forth those ridiculous frames again. This was all picked up on the momentum of the death of Zarqawi, and Bush saw as an opportunity. So he did that little bit of staging and went over there and did his little kiss up with the new prime minister. And they come back here and they're trying to get some traction on this because the gay marriage thing didn't work. The immigration thing isn't working for them. They got nothing on Social Security. All they're going back to is that same frame of like...
Don't forget English being declared the official language. That's very important.
The other big win for them, right?
Right, right.
But so now they go back to this thing like Democrats are wussies. So this is still the thing they're trying to do, but it's not going to stick. Did he get any bump in the approval ratings since this thing?
I think he might have gotten a point. And you know...
That's nothing.
The reality is that... The bar is set so low for this guy. It's mind-boggling. I mean, literally, if he doesn't come in front of the American public and drool, then it's yippee, let's create a national holiday for him because, you know, he didn't drool. It's time that this country has a president that actually does something, that actually sounds like he's got a brain in his head, and actually isn't congratulated for doing nothing. I mean, if you look at the events of the last week, he got on a plane and went to Baghdad.
Yeah.
Big deal.
Right.
I mean, what did that do?
5.5 hours.
Yeah. Okay, so we killed al-Zarqawi. What did that do? I mean, yesterday, almost every day there's dozens of Iraqis getting killed. 3 U.S. soldiers killed yesterday. I just saw there's 2 others that are missing today. So the violence has not stopped. In fact, it's escalated. The other big news that apparently was supposed to give him this great big resurgence is Karl Rove not getting indicted. You know, it's really not something to brag about. The guy still reeks of scandal. He's as dirty as they come. He probably was guilty for what we all know he did in the CIA leak case. But, you know, the fact that he did not get indicted, that's again reason for cheer in the Bush administration. So these are non-issues.
And also, it seems to me that, you know, the one thing I found encouraging, and I read a bit about it just before you got here, was that there are people within the ranks of the Republicans who are sick of this war, who are sick of the way the president's been handling this war, and speaking out about it. And there has been some talk for the first time, if I'm not mistaken, about, you know, reengaging in congressional oversight of this damn administration before it gets to be, you know, even worse and worse. I mean, I don't know if that's going to happen, but at least the conversations are there because Americans are fed up.
Well, it depends who's running Congress, Mark. I mean, you know, you saw what happened in Congress this week. You know, this is all about politics, not policy.
Right.
You know, they went in there and debated for how many hours? I mean, I fell asleep reading about the debate. Can you imagine these guys actually staying in this chamber for 11, 12, 14 hours debating? But it was all, you know, politically based. It had nothing to do with actually helping soldiers. It was all to set the stage for Republicans come November and to try to pin Democrats into a corner and make it look like they're not supporting the troops. And that's what this is all about. This is a ploy to paint Democrats as unpatriotic and not supporting the troops. And
so how do we get – what's the Democratic response? I know there was a plan put forth by Reid and Pelosi today, but I cannot get on – the House Leader website. Do you know how they're going to counter this and how they're going to... I mean, it seems to be a no-brainer in the sense that it's sort of like, make the differentiation. The war on terror is not the war on Iraq, and fighting both of them is failing.
Well, I think what they're trying to do... the war is failing?
Yeah. What I'm saying is that there was this attempt by Boehner yesterday to put the two together. And the bottom line is that from all evidence, Iraq is exacerbating global terrorism. And because of our presence in Iraq, we are unable to address either of them properly.
Yeah, but, you know, that's you're arguing a very rational point.
Yeah.
The reality is, for political purposes, what worked in 2004 and what they're setting the stage for again.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the front page of the Times yesterday, Bush says, you know, warning that Democrats that an early withdrawal of troops would set back counterterrorism efforts and endanger our country. That's what they did in 04. That's what they're doing again. Rove's speech in New Hampshire Monday evening was all about making those same connections. You know, we were attacked on 9/11. We went after the terrorists. The terrorists are in Iraq. If we pull out of Iraq, the terrorists win. They attack us over here. Let's stay there so that we don't have to fight them here. We fight them there. That's, they're going down the exact same path.
You think it's
going
to work this time?
You know, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be dangerous. But you know, if you look at what the Democrats are doing or maybe not doing, I don't know. They're not exactly, you know, giving us a lot of reason for to be confident.
And also, Dick Cheney's, he's, you're right. You're absolutely right, because I got a piece right here. Dick Cheney said in a radio interview that the war in Iraq, he says, I think is in part responsible for the fact that we haven't been hit again in nearly 5 years. That's no accident. So that is the frame that they are applying to this whole situation. I can't imagine, with 2,500 deaths and possibly three more today, that Americans are going to buy this crap. I mean, they've got to know.
You would think, Mark, right? You would think you would think that somebody might sit back and just say, "Wait a second, you know, we've heard this spiel before, and it's not going to work this time." But most people don't pick up a newspaper. Most people don't watch the news. And you know, if you hit them where it hurts, which is fear, you know, you see what they're doing this week. They're going right back to the fear mongering because they know that's what's worked. And when you know Karl Rove has something that's worked, he sticks with it. And so you see that's what they're doing. And whereas a few weeks ago and a few months ago, they were sort of seeing a splintering in the Republican Party, you know, these guys want to get reelected. So they were going against the Bush administration saying, we've got to find some sort of an exit strategy. Now you see sort of like the Republicans have succumbed back to the Bush administration and they've sort of gotten unity within the party. And now they're saying the Democrats don't have unity. The reality is the Democrats right now, at least 50% of them are now behind the Murtha resolution. So if they can, and I think Pelosi is really behind trying to get a lot of popularity behind that. So, you know, are they going to get uniform agreement across the party? Perhaps not. But if a majority of the Democrats can get behind this Murtha resolution, something which John Kerry is pushing, and say, we've got to have these troops out now because this war is a failure, then at least we've got something that's the distinction you're talking about with the from the Republican Party.
Well, I'm glad they've gone, you know, on some level, the other option was for the for those in charge of the planet right now, the neocon death cult, to facilitate or enable another dramatic terrorist attack on American soil to frighten the hell out of everybody. On some level, I'm relieved that they haven't chosen that course, because I hold them capable of doing that.
They are truly capable of doing anything.
Well,
look, that's what's scary.
It is. We're talking to Andy Ostroy. We're going to keep him in the studio. We're going to bring in Steve Hill, the author of 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, and get a little conversation going on a more structural conversation about how to repair democracy, not a partisan conversation per se. So stick around for that. We'll be back. It's the Mark Maron Show.
Is your sunscreen doing its job? Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
We are in studio with Andy Ostroy from the ostroyreport.blogspot.com. And right now, we have another guest in studio. Stephen Hill is the director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation. He's the former senior analyst and co-founder of the Center for Voting and Democracy / Fair Vote. His books include Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics. He's a co-author of Whose Vote Counts. Steve Hill's writings have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times. The title of the new book explains what it's about, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, an Owner's Manual for Concerned Citizens. He's here in studio with us now. Welcome to the show, Steve Hill.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
In the book, you cite the problems with the system as it stands now. Those are voting tabulation and obstruction, civic interest in government, i.e. apathy, diminishing vision in ideas and leaders, the complete horrification of the campaign process and the candidates themselves. Then there's the problem that politicians no longer represent the people, and the people know that. Does this all sound about right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think most Americans say, just look at the voter turnout. I mean, in California, we just had a primary election. It was one of the lowest turnouts we've ever had in our history. Fewer than 30% of eligible adult voters turned out to vote. So voters are, you know, they're talking loud and clearly, just not in the way you'd hope in a democracy, by not showing up. And that's one indicator right there.
Well, it's an interesting thing because, you know, we had a little event last night with an Air America comrade of mine, Sam Cedar, did a book reading last night for about 30 people. In L.A., that's a good turnout for a book reading, apparently. And it very quickly afterwards, after the presentation, became a town hall meeting full of anger, a certain amount of desperation, a feeling of futility. And a lot of it revolved around the first topic in your book, 1 out of 10, the idea of securing the vote, that there is a strong sense that if we cannot guarantee that the voting system is properly enforced or fair, what the hell's the point of having any more conversation about anything?
Exactly. I mean, that's the, you know, the fundamental part of any democracy is, can you count the votes? In the last two presidential elections, 2000 and 2004, there were numerous irregularities that went on around the country. So, you know, we could go through them all, but probably your listeners are, you know, at this point, a lot of people are aware that things were wrong. What we need to know is how to fix it. And so that's what I really tried to address in this book, and what are the solutions. And in terms of securing the vote, they have to do, first of all, with creating a fair and impartial election administrators. I mean, you know, the technology doesn't matter at all, whether you're on paper ballots or computers, if the election officials themselves are crooked, because we've had history in this country of ballot boxes disappearing, paper ballots disappearing, ballot boxes being stuffed. So, first of all, you have to have impartial and fair election officials, and that leads to the second point that I have is professionalization of election administrators. Most people don't realize that a lot of election administrators, they got these jobs years ago when, you know, we were still using paper ballots and pens and what have you. Now we're using computers, sophisticated databases. It's a complex job, and yet for them it's all on the job training. There's no place you go to, no school you go to
right,
learn how to run our elections. I mean, in one county in California that I'm familiar with, the election administrator, the head of elections, started out a few years before answering phones behind the desk, you know, beginning level job. And before that, he was writing product descriptions for a seafood company. I mean, these are the sorts of people that have drifted into running our elections.
My dad was watching a polling station in New Mexico, and he's just a bored guy. He's got nothing to do, and he was calling me saying, I don't know what the hell I'm doing here.
Well, the training for poll workers is inadequate. You know, and when you look at other democracies around the world, you see that this is not how they conduct
uh-huh.
their elections. They actually, it is a profession, the people who run their elections. They do fund the elections. They do have good equipment that you can be certain counts the ballots correctly and securely. So this is not rocket science. It's just that we aren't paying enough attention, and we aren't investing enough resources into it.
But what's to stop those things from being bought out? What's to stop those things from being corrupted if you set up a situation where it's done professionally and in a nonpartisan way?
Well, I mean, there's other things that you build in with the voting equipment itself. For instance, one of the things that I call for in the book is what I call public interest voting equipment, where instead of the way it is now, where you have these for-profit corporations with their proprietary software that, you know, is not open source and all these sorts of things, instead other countries have gone a completely different route. They have the government itself, working with the private sector, contracts to create the equipment. They own the source code. It's done all under open sunshine laws, under public hearings. It's all watched very carefully. And then you use the same equipment everywhere, so you don't have the poor counties using the crummy equipment and the wealthy counties with the good equipment.
Right.
So there's, you know, these are the sorts of things that other places are doing. I mean, to give you an example, the country of Brazil.
Yeah.
You walk in to vote on a computerized voting system. You touch a button for the candidate you want, and a photo comes up on the screen so you can visually verify, yeah, that's the candidate I want.
Huh.
So you don't have, you know, undervotes, overvotes. You don't have Jewish voters voting for Pat Buchanan like you had in 2000, because when Pat Buchanan's mug comes up on the screen, they say, my God, no, that's not who I meant.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I mean, here it is that, you know, we're the lone remaining superpower, and yet we're playing catch-up to countries like Brazil, India, Belgium, and others that are already doing these sorts of practices.
And that's by design, by corrupt political organizations that want to make it easily fixable.
Well, I mean, some
on
of
some
it,
level?
It's hard to know whether it's by design or just neglect. I mean, I tend to look at it as like a, it's an infrastructure question, and it's like watching a bridge crossing the river, and it's creaking. We've known it's been creaking, and we just don't pay attention, and we don't fix it. I mean, there are other allegations and disturbing evidence of other things going on with parties are trying to manipulate things, so some of that is going on as well. It's a whole combination of things.
All right, let's get to point two, expand voter participation. How do you plan to encourage that?
Well, you know, again, looking at what other democracies do, which is what I like to do, I think it's good to look at best practices, and we, in the United States, we shouldn't be afraid to learn from other places. In those countries, if you have a pulse and you breathe, you're allowed to vote, and if you're eligible, 18 years of age, because they use a practice called universal voter registration. When you turn 18, you're automatically registered to vote.
Felons as well?
Felons, in most places, a lot of felons can register to vote. In the United States, Vermont allows felons to vote right now, but most states don't. So, in other words, you turn 18, you're sent something in the mail saying, congratulations, you are now registered to vote. Now, if we did this in the United States, 60 million eligible voters who are not on the rolls, about 30% of eligible voters, would be added to the rolls immediately. And ironically, a lot of them are young people, minorities, poor people. Those are the people who aren't on the rolls. And
well,
so it would really change the it would change the quality of the electorate itself if we were to do this sort of practice.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good idea to me. We're going to talk about more good ideas. We've got Steve Hill with us. The book is 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, an owner's manual for concerned citizens. Steve will be appearing Saturday, June 17th. That's tomorrow at the Calabasas High School with Scott Ritter. We'll give you more information on that in a minute.
And now a small orphan made his iPod. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. We're in studio here with Andy Ostroy. OstroyReport.blogspot.com. You go to MarkMaron.com and link up to that. He's here hanging out. We've also got Steve Hill, the author of 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, an owner's manual for concerned citizens. Stephen Hill will be appearing with Scott Ritter and Paul Koritz, who's a state assemblyman here in California, at the Calabasas High School Theater. That's 22855 West Mulholland Highway in Calabasas tomorrow at 2:30. Scott Ritter and is also a fast-talking, very intense, informative guy, as are you, Steve Hill. This is going to be an engaging afternoon of political conversation, my friends. So let's move on to number three. We've got up to increase voter choice with instant runoff voting. What is instant runoff voting?
Instant runoff voting is a method that's being used in various parts of the U.S. and around the world. Most recently in San Francisco started using instant runoff voting. And with that, this electoral system, instead of just picking one candidate when you go into the voting booth, you get to rank candidates, a first choice, second choice, and a third choice. And if your first choice doesn't win, your vote goes to your second choice as your runoff choice. Now, if we had used this, for instance, in the 2000 presidential election, the 100,000 Ralph Nader voters in Florida would have had the option of ranking a second choice, and there's no question that tens of thousands of them would have put Al Gore. He would have been the recipient of all those runoff votes, and we would have had a different outcome in Florida and for the presidency. And in some ways, more importantly, the winner in Florida would have had a majority of the popular vote, which the winner did not have in 2000. And in many states throughout this country, winners don't often have a majority of the popular vote, which means you can't be certain the correct candidate is winning the election.
So you would get rid of that as well, the Electoral College system.
We would get rid of the Electoral College. We would have a national direct election using instant runoff voting to make sure that the winner is the one that has a majority of the popular vote, and particularly by getting rid of the Electoral College. And one of the problems with the way we do it now is, as we've seen in the last two presidential elections, it came down to Ohio and Florida. I mean, you know, those two elections decided the outcome in 2000 and 2004, and they will decide it again in 2008. And that completely colors the Electoral College map when you start figuring out what candidates can win. You know, it's got to, if a Democrat's going to win, it's got to be a Democrat that can win in Ohio and Florida, not in California or New York.
Right.
So, and most states that in this process are shut out of the presidential election. The candidates don't go to those states. They don't come to California or New York or Texas, any of these places, because they know who's going to win. We can already tell you who's going to win in those states. So by doing a national direct election with instant runoff voting, more voters would be engaged, more parts of the country would be engaged, and we would really be able to have a national conversation about who are we as a country, what are the issues, instead of what are the issues to a handful of swing voters in Ohio. That's
right.
What the national presidential election comes down to.
Exactly.
Is a handful of swing voters in Ohio. And then and the other thing I would point out, the way we do the president right now, elect the president, it makes it easier to commit electoral fraud. Because if you know it's going to come down to Ohio and Florida, that means you only have to change the outcome of, say, 537 votes in Florida, as
right.
we saw.
Right, or come down to a district.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're doing it nationwide, you know, just in the 2000 presidential election, it was a 500,000 vote difference between Gore and Bush, and in the 2004 it was 3 million vote difference between Bush and Kerry. So it becomes much more difficult to rig an election when you're doing a national direct election that way.
Well, that's interesting because in the runoff voting, the ranking thing would also enable whoever wins to see the number of people that chose him second, although he's the winner, and maybe try to incorporate some of the things that are important to that that bunch of voters into what he is planning on doing.
That's absolutely correct, Mark. I mean, like in the 2000 election, Ralph Nader at one point was polling 15% of the vote. But as other voters started, you know, making that strategic calculation, well, I like what Ralph does, I like what he says, but let's face it, if I vote for him, I'm going to end up with the greater of two evils, and so I'm going to go with Al Gore. And so Nader's numbers dropped to about 2.7% of the popular vote. Whereas if they had instant runoff voting, that 15% or even higher could have put Nader 1, put Gore 2, and that way we get a truer read of where the electorate stands with instant runoff voting, and you get to see how the coalitions form. You can actually, at the end of the election, in San Francisco, we get a readout that shows, okay, here's the first round, how many number one rankings the candidates had, we eliminated the last place candidate, now we see where the next place rankings go. You see the coalitions forming that produce the winner. It's a fabulous system, and that's what we should be doing in the United States.
Now, in number six here, you say overhaul the U.S. Senate. How does that look?
Well, I mean, the reason for doing this is that it's just the most unrepresentative body that we have in the United States. I mean, it comes from the 18th century at this point, and it was put in place in order to put a shield on too much democracy.
To protect us from congressmen.
Well, when Congress put this in place, when the founding fathers and framers drafted this, the largest state was 12 times the size of the smallest state. Now, California is 70 times the size of Wyoming,
right.
Yet California has the same representation in the United States Senate. But it's not just a matter of representation. We've done analyses, and I've put them in the book, where you can show that, for instance, federal allocation of federal tax dollars is going to the low-population red conservative states because they have more representation per capita than the high population blue states. The blue states are subsidizing the red states, even as the red states are out there whining about big government and they want lower taxes.
Right.
I mean, it's the ultimate irony, and the only way to really stop this kind of craziness that's going on. And you can look at lots of legislative bills that pass or get stopped, and you can see they're stopped by senators who represented maybe 15% of the nation's population, and they can thwart what the other 85% of the population wants.
So the solution is to add more senators per population?
There's a few things we could do. One, we could just get rid of the Senate and have a unicameral legislature. I mean, this is what Nebraska has, a unicameral legislature. There's nothing wrong with unicameral.
What does that mean?
It means just one house.
Right.
No, not two houses. Or we could give California more senators, give the large population states more senators. Or another thing we could do, the Senate is really the only upper chamber in the world that has the number of powers that it has. Usually the lower chamber has more powers than the upper chamber. But in the Senate, it's been invested with all these powers of confirming judges, treaties, all these sorts of things. So we could just take away a lot of the powers of the Senate and make the House a more prominent body.
Okay, because it was my understanding, like you said before, that the Senate was put into place because they considered the House to be sort of rabble, and that the senators were landowners, and that they needed somebody to be a filter.
That's exactly right. I mean, some of the framers of the Constitution were not exactly what we call little d Democrats. They were elitists.
Yeah.
People like John Jay said the people who own the country ought to govern it. And
right.
So in order to shield what they thought would be too much democracy in the House, they ended up creating the Senate. But also the underside of the seamy underside of this is that the senators, they were the states they were trying to protect were slave states.
Right.
And so the slave states were really given this basically an affirmative action, if you will, to give them more representation per capita than the non-slave states.
Wow. All right. So now the number eight is minimize money's role. I think we can understand that before we run out of time. But reform the Supreme Court. I'd like to hear about that a little.
Well, I mean, we saw with the John Roberts and the Samuel Alito confirmation hearing some of the problems.
Right.
And so what we should do there is we should have term limits for Supreme Court justices, for one. We should have, a retirement age. I mean, most countries have a retirement age around 70 or 75 for
when
these
justices.
When
they can't think anymore, maybe.
Exactly, when they can barely get to their chambers. And we should have multiple appointing authorities. This is what we do already in many bodies in the United States. And you know, instead of just having the president appointing, we should have multiple appointing authorities. So you really get what you want, ideally, on your Supreme Court is a range of viewpoints, a range of judicial viewpoints. And, you know, when you start calling people like John Paul Stevens a moderate or even Sandra Day O'Connor, when she was on the Supreme Court, being called a moderate, you know that your court is ideologically tilted too far to the right. And so these sorts of things that I've proposed as reforms would help to bring the court back to the ideological center.
Well, this all sounds great, and the 10th one is restore faith in government, which obviously would happen if all these changes were made. Now, let's be honest, Stephen Hill. Now, let me tell people again. The book is 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. You can link to it on markmaron.com. Let's be honest, how far away from are we from enacting a lot of this stuff, and what has to happen?
Well, what needs to happen is people need to get involved. I mean, issues like voting equipment and instant runoff voting. The city of Minneapolis just voted to put instant runoff voting on the ballot. You can do that at the local level. So in Minneapolis, they're going to vote on it this November, whether to use that system. Public financing of elections, we didn't mention that, but we just passed this at the local level in San Francisco. In Los Angeles, they're trying to pass clean money at the local level. So people need to get involved at the local level, taking small steps and as we build towards these bigger steps. But let me tell you, as bad as people think things are now, it's going to get worse because the barriers that are there because of this antiquated political system that we have are not going to go away. You're going to increasingly see the Congress out of touch with the American people on a whole host of issues like health care and the environment, and energy, more so than even now. So, down the road, seeds that we're planting right now are going to be the sprouts that become the bigger plants and then the trees that are going to make this happen. I like to remind people when I go to Europe and I interview people a lot there to ask them about their political system. I asked some Germans, how many of you in 1980 thought that in 9 years the Berlin Wall would fall? And they said, we didn't think in 1988 the Berlin Wall was going to fall. So you never know where we are and what debacle is just around the corner that's going to spur new looks at reform. So people need to just be active, involved, out there working at your local level, pushing within your organizations, within the Democratic Party and other organizations, Green Party, what have you, to start pushing these reforms. I mean, there's no shortcut. It is a lot of work, but without them, things are just going to get worse.
Awesome. Man, I have to get involved more. That's what I feel right now. Our guest has been Stephen Hill. Again, the book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy.
There's a website for the book. If I can give that,
sure.
www.10steps.net. That's 10steps.net.
And it looks like this thing you're doing tomorrow with Scott Ritter is you can get that at impeachpack.org, that information. It is an impeachment discussion.
That's correct.
All right, well, that'd be good if we can make that happen by 2008.
Good luck with that one, but I think it's good to talk about it.
I think you're right.
We don't have to always, there are other gains other than actually winning everything we embark on. I
mean, absolutely.
Republicans have done that.
Here we go. We're leaving. We're coming back. We'll talk a little bit more with Andy Ostroy. We'll do some jokes. Stay with us.
If you really believe Mark Maron is the one and true Christ, you won't want to miss his short order news coming up next. Amen.
Prozac is not effective against him. Mark Maron.
That's true, actually. I'll break through anything. I can break through any wall. Any haze, man. Andy Ostroy, ostroyreport.blogspot.com, still in the room as we listen to Stephen Hill. I'll tell you, it all sounded pretty damn good to me.
I think Stephen should run for president. You know, in fact, I was sitting and listening, and I realized that he's two steps away from a 12-step. You know,
that's right.
Yeah, and then I think we're really onto something.
But here, you know what's so weird to me, Andy, is that like there's so many things that seem such like, you know, so practical, so simple to achieve, to facilitate, to make this a more legitimate system, that it's shameful that we haven't progressed like this. Just shameful.
Because the things that we're trying to change and reform are the mechanisms are controlled by the other side. And until there's, you know, it's kind of a catch-22 here. How do you change a system that's being dominated by people who are seemingly crooked and totally in control? And
but let's be honest. Let's be honest. They've been controlled by both sides over the years. And both sides have used the vulnerabilities of this system to promote themselves. And I think the lesson to be learned is that those both sides, more so than not, don't represent the will of the American people, and that is not their concern. So, I mean, what we're really addressing here, and I think the way he phrased it was great, is just that we're dealing with arcane and crumbling infrastructure that is easily exploited by whoever's in power, and the people that get screwed every time are the people who vote, are the people that this government is supposed to represent. And it just seems like on a very simplistic level, that ranking system, that sounds awesome.
The ranking system used in Europe, but that's one of the ways that conservatives, their opponents, don't, you know, fight against it. They say, hey, that's a European system.
Right, yeah. We don't want stinky European
system. We don't want to vote like Holland.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, Holland, which is clean and good. Yeah. Everything European is good. It's all better there. There's no doubt about that, right, Jim?
I agree.
The reason we live here is what?
To get away from Europe.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. It all started there. But, I mean, I think that I don't know why it's just to see the frustration on people's faces, and like even these little events that we do, like with Sam's event or when we used to do Morning Sedition live, is that the amazing thing about the left and about the people that listen to Air America and the people that really want change is that they're not easily entertained because they really want answers, and their frustration is so tangible and so visceral, and you really don't know who the hell to talk to, because like you're saying that, you know, the Democrats have not defined themselves recently as people of action or people of vision. And when it comes right down to it, you're dealing with people that are like, I don't think I can run for something, but I'm gonna. And those might be the people we have to rely on, or people that take it upon themselves to get involved at a grassroots level, to get involved on school boards, to get involved in the Secretary of State's office, to get involved in electoral committees. I mean, you just got to hope that people are not careerist, that there are at least some people. Yeah, see, the Republicans have worked in shameless careerism and shameless selfishness into what they believe in, and then they just exploit the passion of religious zealots to facilitate whatever the hell they want. Whereas people on the left, you know, we want to engage in debate and conversation and keep our minds open, but a lot of times there's not so many people that are willing to give up the time to say, you know what, I'm going to dedicate the rest of my life to try and do to change government.
Well, you know, you mentioned before about how both sides of the aisle are responsible for the system we have, and that's true. But over the years, you know, politics is politics. It's a dirty game. Whoever goes into politics plays that dirty game, and you have to be a certain kind of person to do that. But I think throughout history, Democrats have always been more so the party of the people than Republicans. We were with somebody last night, and they were commenting on Ann Coulter, and they were saying how she was riffing on global warming as if it's a partisan issue.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between Democrats and Republicans, is that we may play backroom politics, but we recognize what's good for the people. And when we are one people, you know, global warming affects everyone. It doesn't affect Democrats more than Republicans or Republicans more than Democrats. And I think the frustration that Sam may have seen, or you may have seen in the room last night, a lot of that's turning into despair with a lot of people.
Yeah,
I talk to
true.
A lot of people, and they feel like, you know, the old expression, you know, if you don't like the system, go out and change it. But if the system is controlled by the bad guys, and no matter what you do, you can't change it. If they rig elections, if they keep people away from the polls, that's when despair sets in. And I think we have a lot of that today. And I'm not sure until we get rid of the Catherine Harris's and Ken Blackwell's and people like Wally O'Dell, who promised the president to deliver an election, and he's controlling the Diebold machines because it's his company. Where do you go from there?
Right. That's an uplifting way to end the week.
That's why I'm here. I'm from New York, so I brought you a little New York.
I'm kidding. Well, I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about Al Gore. We'll do that another time. I'm going to do this now. Andy Ostroy, thanks for being here. I want to thank Steve Hill for being here. Nice talking to Vic Garbarini. And now we're going to give you the short order news so you don't, you're not uninformed or caught off guard. The House today handily rejected a timetable for pulling U.S. forces out of Iraq. The GOP-led House approved a resolution saying that setting an Iraq withdrawal date is not in the national interest. Republicans modeled their decree after their popular Let's Bomb Cambodia into the Stone Age resolution of 1969. Acclaimed physicist Stephen Hawking has said that humanity is finally getting close to understanding the origin of the universe. Earlier this week, Hawking predicted that humans would have a lunar settlement within 20 years, a Martian colony in 40, and a war between the two in 60. A 15-year-old girl can enter into a common law marriage in Colorado, and younger girls and boys possibly can too, a state appeals court ruled yesterday. If the law goes into effect, the Denver omelet would now be referred to as Eggs Under Easy. Upon hearing the news, Toys R Us began its own gift registry. To document the court ruling, Michael Moore will be shooting a new movie entitled Bowling for Concubine. Hello! Though the ruling said 12-year-old girls and 14-year-old boys can enter into marriage, it specifically forbade videotaping it. Is this on? All right, next week. Next week, Margaret Cho. Next week. That's going to be interesting, isn't it, Jim?
I don't know what you're talking about,
Mark. That's going to be interesting, Jim.
Huh?
Yeah. I know that you used to. Yeah. All right, David Ray Griffin.
What?
To talk about the 9/11 truth thing. We're going to get to the bottom of the hole in the side of the Pentagon. Swear. Martha Wainwright will be here to sing. Andy Kinworth wrote me to ask, should he bring the funny? I think he will. Have a good weekend, sheeple.
Show.
Huh?
What are you talking about?
Uh-huh.